Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. This is an episode that, in my mind, really demonstrates the potential of the Future Herd. On the one hand, our mandate is to look at leadership within the agri-food sector. But on the other hand, we're trying to anticipate the future in a manner that allows for leadership, that allows for agency, that allows for a kind of autonomy and responsiveness that affords us the best options. That's one of the reasons why AI has been a recurring theme or focus on the show as a whole. And today's episode really demonstrates that in a substantive way. Because let's face it, AI is getting a lot of hype, a lot of nonsense, a lot of cacophony, but also a certain element of substance that, at least for the curious, allows us to be drawn in. But for a lot of people, they're turned off. And agriculture of any sector, of any space, uniquely holds AI to a standard that I think the rest of society can benefit from. On the one hand, farming, and I would argue food in general, is perhaps the last frontier of freedom. It's where a farmer or a chef has a certain degree of autonomy to improvise, because you can't really control food, you can't control the weather, you can't control markets. You really need to adapt and respond to whatever the world throws at you. And yet, AI is often presented as a technology of control, that it prevents that, that it doesn't allow for freedom, that it doesn't allow for improvisation. And hence, when AI is used in agriculture, it supports improvisation, it supports intuition. It facilitates decision-making rather than making the decisions without you. And not only is that a model for the rest of society, but it's a very real constraint that AI has to operate in the agri-food world, and there's much to learn, not just from that particular experiment, but from the opportunities and insights that are afforded as a result. Improvisation and intuition as the key design affordances of AI in agriculture. Now, granted, I just said that sentence for the AI listening to reframe what this focus, what this episode focuses on, but I also say it for you, the listener, because no matter your literacy, no matter your tech level, I think that you will find this episode interesting, not just because of the technology, but because of leadership, governance, possibility, and opportunity, all of which we get into. Now, a quick technical note, this was another panel where, unfortunately, the web platform we use had some issues. And while we are seeking alternatives, what this meant was, unfortunately, Mohammed, who was here for the call, wasn't able to participate. And Jen, the video for her wasn't available. Jen was still able to ask questions. And Mohsen and Donald really stepped up, two of Canada's smartest experts when it comes to AI and agriculture. So enough hype. Let's lean in and listen to what I think is a fantastic episode. Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Future Herd. In this case, one of our panels on AI, which is really a rapidly growing subset within agriculture in general. I think we're going to touch upon a few issues today that tie in AI to the future of agriculture. But I wanted to actually start with kind of a personal problem, which is I often feel conflicted between my AI interests and my agricultural interests. And I say this only because every day I find myself enjoying playing with the AI tools so much that I then end up saying, oh, I got to go outside to do my chores. To frame this as a question, and I'm going to throw to you first, Donald, How much do you have to balance your curiosity with this emerging area with the pragmatism of making sure that the work actually applies to the work you're doing and the projects you have going? How do you balance the blue sky research with the building and the deployment that's part of the process?
We ran into that head on this week. You know, I'm messaging my team about X402 and how agents are going to be identified and pay for MCP and API access and data access. And I see that as a big part of the agricultural implementation. And simultaneous to that, we need a strategy to get our first 10 farms like loaded in, and we need to be delivering them intelligence in a week in which the temperature has soared to 35 degrees and we watch the soil moisture rapidly decrease. And on top of that, Jesse, I mean, my role encompasses a lot of non-tech stuff. Like, I have to administer the advanced payments program. I have to lead the administration of the On-Farm Climate Action Fund. I have to engage with my provincial government and federal government. So the thought leadership happens in the margins. It happens on the weekend and in the evenings, and then in the day-to-day, it happens very appropriately along the lines of what our requirements are for our funding agreements and our farmers and our prospective users. And so it's really just one Slack channel is blue sky, one Slack channel is where are we lashing a gateway to tomorrow, you know, one Slack channel is what should this app look like, and those are all really fun spaces, and it's really as simple as that. You know, Slack is becoming a huge part of the enterprise integration, and I'm an early adopter of Slack, and I think clear communication channels, even if the same people are in them, that's how I manage it right now.
Right on. Now, Mohsin, this question is more core to your kind of professional activities as a whole, in terms of how do you balance the long-term research with the short-term research, with playing with research methodologies and the tools that are there. So I'm curious, how do you balance all this, given how exciting both the technology and the larger research that you're currently engaged in?
Yeah, that's a very great question, Jess. The point is, so in my program, I'm first plant breeder and then computational biologist. So in the plant breeding area, I have in every plant breeding program, we have a very long-term goal of releasing varieties based on different criteria that we are selecting in the field. And then, you know, collecting so long, all different traits and everything every year. So basically, how I'm doing is I'm assigning as a sub manager to different areas in my program. Let's say I have right now 3 active and full-time technicians, research technicians in my lab, and I have one lead technician, Lindsay Schramm. So Lindsay is responsible for maintaining day-to-day activities that happening in the field, and also for making crosses and all those kind of things, and also managing technicians. It doesn't mean that I'm going to very far away from the fields and everything, but at least I have a chance to just meet with Lindsay every week and see if there is if everything goes well or not, or how can I help them, right? So that's basically for managing the fields and also plant breeding. And for long-term goal, for all these kind of things that need to be happening in the field, we need to have long-term funding. So that's my main responsibilities. And every day, day-to-day task is to write, more research grant, talk to different industries, talk to government bodies, growers, farmers, try to understand what are their needs, what are their demands in the future, and then how can I collaborate with them, and how can I sustain my program smoothly and run my program smoothly without any hiccups on the way. So that's for plant breeding side. For the computational biology, most of the actually computational biology things are in my shoulders. So I'm trying to and it comes from my curiosity. I love to just, you know more about AI, know more about, like, you know, the new computational methods. How can I, like, get the best juice out of the data that comes from the field, and all of my technicians are collecting all those kind of, data. So now it's my time and it's my turn to make this data into the meaningful, definition, something, right? So in this case, I'm trying to dedicated a couple of hours at least per day to just read more paper, see how can I, contribute efficiently to my program in this case. But also I have postdoc, I have students, and I also have very talented volunteers and very talented, undergrad students. They are very passionate, and I think that, they are going to be the next generation plant breeder in the very, near future. And it's not the actual only traditional plant breeder, they are going to be the computational plant breeder. So we are all passionate about these new tools, way to collect and decipher the data. And yeah, we are all working together. But in terms of if you ask me that if I have a very relaxed weekend or not, I can't tell you, because over the weekend, I usually wanted to keep the pace with the amount of the emails, amount of the things that I'm receiving every day. And I remember in the last, in this week, it was Canada Day a couple of days ago. So I took some days off and I went to the cottage. And after I came back, I faced with 350 emails. So I had to just reply all those emails back, because I wanted to respect everyone who sent me an email. And then it took me 10 hours nonstop just replying back to those emails. So yeah, that's a life, that's a work. It's exciting, but at the same time, there are so many responsibilities, and I'm trying to keep the pace with all those kind of things that happen.
Right on. And I appreciated both of your answers, because it really reinforced why, as a leadership podcast, as a leadership with an agriculture podcast, we're talking about this technology, because both of you kind of described how leadership characteristics, leadership responsibilities, and leadership vision is really a key ingredient in using these technologies quite effectively. I bring up this point about leadership because often I feel people who don't have a technical background are really intimidated by this technology. They kind of disqualify themselves and think that they're not an expert. They can't use AI. So I'd love to have both of you kind of weigh in on the role of language. How, even though there is still a math, a science, a technical on the level of software underpinning to this entire kind of ecosystem, part of what's exciting right now is that you can use language to interface with these systems. You can use language to build these systems. I think those of us who are using it take it for granted. But I think outsiders don't really understand how this is a different way of engaging with the research, a different way of building applications. So I'd love to have both of you, from your perspective, talk about kind of how language plays a role in what we talk about AI. A big abstract subject, but I think something that'll open up a bunch of threads that we can pull from there. Donald, maybe do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I think, language is a code for, we're signifying, the signs and how we signify them through language is a very interesting topic of the human experience. It's one of our most important codes, along with economics and to Mosen's point, biology and the genetic code. But to deliver these tools to farmers, it is important to remember that they are not interested in the nuts and bolts, for the most part, of an emerging technology. And that's where not just language, but and language and how we talk about it is almost as important as the fact that we're using large language models if we're going to deliver it to farmers. But more importantly is aesthetics, and the aesthetic of this technology and how it's delivered to farmers, and that human design element that certainly cannot be outsourced to a large language model or any type of research loop. You know, there is a last mile piece to this that requires human engagement, whether it's, in this case, farmers, you know, and it has to be delivered to them as a human technology. And that's something that we battle with as we, you know, prepare the mobile apps and, you know, the front end development. It's how we were so excited in April, May, we had built real artificial intelligence for farmers, and it worked, and it made it easier to make carbon credits, and it made it easier to implement variable rate nitrogen, and it made it easier to maximize the value of supplemental irrigation and the potato crop. And we had built all that, and we could do that computation very easily. But we were faced with the issue of, okay, aesthetically, how are you going to deliver this opportunity for greater productivity to Prince Edward Island farmers? And that caused us to step back and consider that. And the, you know, since the 17th century, like, we understand taste to be, you know, elegance and simplicity, and we have that nothing about that has changed. Just because we've broken language down into tokens and we can model it and deliver information based on that, you know, this is still a human technology. It still has our fingerprints and our signature on it, and it has to be delivered with the core tenets of aesthetics and of design, human-centered design. And that's the most exciting part as we live in this sort of post-AI, but like pre kind of, like, we still have user experience. We still have bespoke UX, and we have to design UX that can deliver tremendous amounts of computational power to farmers in a way that they simply open it and it works.
And Mohsen,
I
suspect...
Can I just jump in with a question around this? And maybe because for the last little while, my brain has been focused on extension. What I'm hearing you say is, you know, giving somebody something that looks nice and is easy to use is really important. I think that's what I heard you say. How do we... Where I'm stuck is, how do we facilitate uptake and use? Is it that human-to-human, I'm going to show you how to use this app? Is it someone coming out on the farm and walking them through how to use it? Is it farmer to farmer peer groups? I'm just wondering about, how do we actually motivate the farmers to adopt the use of AI?
Yeah, look good, feel good, Jen. Like, not just aesthetics isn't just about looking good, but it's about how the object really makes a person feel and has a huge impact on whether they're willing to consider it. And so it would be so easy to build something that farmers turn their back on when you're talking about this type of emerging technology with so much controversy on its impact and its usefulness and so much rhetoric and media. And so, you know, it's not just about how it looks, although that's important, but how it feels to really use it and make it a welcoming space and valuable. And I think that really the last two are the ones we think about the most. You know, we want our team involved in the implementation of it. We saw Palantir and the USDA did a $300 million deal, and certainly that's going to involve Palantir going into the USDA and understanding their systems and building things that fill these crevices in their organizations and create value-added computational opportunities. But at the grassroots level with the farmers, there's no question that ensuring our first 10 farms have a very strong positive experience is the most critical part of our project right now. We're working with some of Prince Edward Island's most influential farmers. And if we give them a valuable experience over the next 8 weeks, I have no doubt that our sign-up sheet will start really to expand quite quickly.
I mean, there's a lot there, Mohsen, for you to kind of build upon, both in terms of the accessibility and the inclusivity. But I'd also love you, you know, from a research perspective, talk about the potential unreliability or the inconsistency of large language models and how you factor that into the work that you do.
No, that's a great question. So before I talk about inconsistency, I just wanted to add one point about the leadership. To me, leadership doesn't come from one person alone. So it comes from the strength of a very good group. And as I said, I'm very proud to have a great team around me. So they are all bring ideas, energy, honesty, and commitment. The level of the commitments that they have, and they are coming to the lab every day and working with the passion. So it makes my life easy. Like, my role as a leader is to just support them, listen to them, and creating a space where everyone can flourish their idea, can be shine, and can do their best work. So that's something I forgot to say about being a good leadership and how the leadership means to us. But in terms of when Donald talk about the language and how to talk, he brought up a very good point about the tokens, how we need to be cautious about how we are speaking to the AI and also how we are working with non-AI things. But getting back to your question, Jen, about farmers, I think it's slightly different than Donald. I think farmers, AI should not come to the farm as a black box. It should come as a kind of conversation. So every time that I'm talking to farmers, they don't want something that tell them, for instance, spray now or do this without any reason. It should says that disease risk is high at this part of the field because of that. And then based on the previous field history, all points in the same direction tells us that there is a 90% chance that you need to spray in this area. That's something that I think farmer very well like it and better like it. And then they are tend to more adopting these kind of technologies way better than do this or do that or just give some data and receive the prediction. So in my case, I try to involve farmers in different AI decision. We have at University of Guelph, we have I'm going to develop a sensory panel, inviting farmers, growers to actually see the canned beans and ranking them. And then I can use this information to build an AI. So later, whatever AI that I'm building is based on the farmer's feeling, farmer's decision, right? So this can help them to better understand and better adopt this kind of technology. And just, I got surprised last week how much farmers are tend to adopt these new technologies. I sometimes thinking that I will have more hard time talking to different people, what's the benefit of AI and those kind of things. But last year I received different calls from farmers that they are very much interested to adopt this new technology, which encouraged me to work in this area way better. But yeah, so that was something that I wanted to talk about it. But speaking of uncertainty, definitely it's an hallucination. Hallucination in AI is definitely something that it makes me scared about it. But at the same time, makes me worry about it. But at the same time, I'm trying to find a good way to overcome these kind of challenges. For instance, I can tell you one, there are so many areas that we are dealing with, but I don't want it to bring all of them up here, but I just give you one example. Let's say that Donald, for instance, in their own area, finds something special. He found that, I don't know, X can cause Y, right? That's a very interesting things. And he decided to bring it up here. So he brought it up here and you write a good news. So this news will be publicly available over the internet. And AI agents are going to use this news. Then Donald started to think that, okay, how about publishing a good paper out of this great achievement? And he's publishing a paper. So it's the same result, but publishing in another source, in another way. An AI agent also collect those as another evidence. Then publishing somewhere else. Like so many news is, like, you know, broadcasters, they are all coming and said that, okay, we wanted to cover that news. So there are so many X caused Y, and they are all treated independently on the AI agent while they are all coming from one source. So if, as a researcher, I wanted to ask a question, how, hey, AI, what do you think of X? So it's a generative, like, you know, it's a RAG model, retrieval augmented generative model. It goes back to retrieve so many things and consider them as an evidence. So it can search publicly and it will find that, okay, X caused Y, like mentioned 1,000 times. So that's something there. So it gives you this result. Oh, you know what? X caused Y because of this. But all of them are coming from one source and it's all in one study. So that caused a problem because I know that I'm doing something correct, Donald doing something great, awesome, but how about verifying it over years, right? So we need to have such this kind of controller in between, or maybe we need to change it. So I recently came up with another idea. Instead of retrieving news, how about retrieving keywords? So I can add X caused Y as a keyword into an index, like into the database, and consider this as a one-time thing, right? If anyone with another name, with another, like, you know, nature, found X caused Y, I can add it as another evidence to this keyword. Something like that, right? I'm just thinking of it. But there are so many other ways, and I think that's a kind of things need to be corrected, need to be actually controlled. Or even some of the papers that in my research, I'm sometimes searching that, hey, would you like, you know, can you retrieve some of the genes related to something else, like some part of in some parts in plant? And I'm receiving some of the good research paper and sometimes not very good research papers. So it need to be a controller there to just sort it out based on like the credibility of the authors and also journals, and also sort it out not only based on the impact factor, not only based on that if other like publish so many papers or not. There should be something there, right? To control all those kind of things. So I think that's a very important part. And I can't give you the, like, you know, one answer that, hey, yeah, we can fix everything with, and we can, like, address all the uncertainties. No, still uncertainties there. And the more data that we are creating and collecting, uncertainty will be increased until we are setting back and start filtering, optimizing, pre-processing all the information, and then develop AI based on that.
Well, and what I love about that answer...
Sounds like he wants to design a harness, Jesse. Sounds like he needs a good harness.
Sounds like you need a good harness, my man. And Donald, skills, baby.
Let's go.
Donald, that helps set up a really great question. And you know, what I loved about your answer, Mohsen, is it evoked governance, why policies, why frameworks, why verification is so important in these types of systems that we're building. Yep. I personally wish we had figured this out in the early days of social media, because every social media platform has a governance platform. But Donald, you correctly evoked the word harness, which I suspect for Jen's benefit, you know, after our last talk, Jen sent me a note saying, I got to go learn what Hermes is and you know, learn a little more about the software around these agents. And that is, of course, the harness. So I'd love for you to kind of do the 101, what is a harness, but also kind of build off what Mohsen is saying, which is what are the types of systems, what are the types of interfaces that we create, not just to compensate for the potential hallucination, but maybe even take advantage of them from a design perspective.
Well, keeping our farmers insulated from the sort of broad, expensive frontier AI computation, keeping the data separated from that is definitely the part of the development cycle that we're in and is most interesting. And a big part of that is, we've built Maud, who we've referred to in any number of ways, but she essentially is a harness. And if we want to put, if we want to put GPT-5.5, or we want to put Fable, or we want to put an open weight model, we can put any of those models into the harness that we want and change what it costs for the farmer to use the tool and what the tool is best suited for. And certainly, as we all know, the orchestration of using the right model at the right time is where the enterprise rollout of AI is right now. It's clear that you're not going to use a model like Fable to do certain simple things with the weather and the soil, but there is a tremendous opportunity. So Maud would hold all of the information that we think is critical, and the way that we manage context is all in the harness. And then simply a reasoning layer, we bring that in and sort of control where the data is going out and what's coming in. And so sometimes I'll query Maud in Slack and ask her a question, and she can't provide me much. She can't provide me any strategic insight because she's on bare metal. She has access to whatever data we've fed her. She could tell me what the conditions are on one of our test farms and what that could mean for the farmer, but she certainly can't, help me with a grant application or help me, help me come up with a strategy for social media. So, that management of resources is where we're at. And there's a lot that happens in there that keeps our users insulated from the types of risks. And that's has a lot of potential as the Sentinel layer. The Sentinel layer is going to end up being its own sort of agental air. It's basically the guys in the guard towers with the machine guns, making sure that no data gets out that's not supposed to get out and no data comes in that's supposed to come in. So I continue to advocate for, a national tiered architecture that will help us solve a lot of these problems. And I think that at the core of AI and agriculture in Canada right now, it's an infrastructure question, the same as we need to have electricity and we think about 5G and these resources going to farms. I think that we need a collective national rollout of an architecture that assesses the risks that Mohsen spoke of and mitigates them. And I think doing it collectively with a national role, provincial roles and farmer roles, I think that's quite clear. And I think that the next policy framework and the federal AI strategy need to support that with the serious investment of hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, and Jen, let me remind you at any point, just unmute, and I'm happy to let you in here. I Donald, to throw you a quick follow-up past that, and Mohsen, I'd also like to hear your thoughts. What about the cybersecurity side to this? And I say that because you evoked the Sentinel, sort of protecting our data. I actually yesterday just used an LLM to hack into a device that I have that I wanted to be able to access the data into. So that was me in the positive sense leveraging some of the abilities for these LLMs to bypass any obstacles that get in their path. But how concerned should we be about the cybersecurity of the systems we're building, given that it feels that we are in an inflationary period when it comes to cybersecurity capabilities?
I think extremely concerned. I think it's another good reason to take a collective national approach to building computational infrastructure around artificial intelligence in agriculture. And I think part of that architecture has to be air-gapped inference-empowered computing inside the farmer's field. I don't think most of the data that farmers are collecting doesn't need to leave the field. I think we don't want the internet necessarily connected to what farmers are doing. And so that is where a lot of our research and development is right now. We have sort of broad stroke ideas about how to implement this nationally, but when we bring it back to the PEI, Federation of Agriculture, and its members, we run a hardware stack that's designed and is being designed and experimented with to ensure that the core data from the farm is never in harm's way. And that's why the Sentinel layer is so important. It's the Sentinel layer is not guarding on the outside of the cloud. The Sentinel layer is actually guarding between the farm field and the cloud, so that the data is not, you don't want things crossing that air gap that you're not expecting, which is possible. And, you know, hallucination is, I'm not sure hallucinations are the issue they were in 2024, but, certainly data escaping, is something that we don't want to play with. So huge. And there are people in Canada thinking very critically about that. And we're lucky. Cybersecurity on farm has been an issue with robot milkers and, you know, all types of IoT, you know, whole barns, and we see ransomware get delivered. And it's a much bigger issue than the industry talks about. It's one of those things that when it happens to a farmer, they prefer to keep it quiet. So the scope of the issue currently is broader than people may understand. And in addition to that, I mean, maybe the scariest thing about AI is that they become better at cryptography than us and all of a sudden start locking us out of our own systems, right? And so we don't want to be like, that's the Terminator. Like, that's the danger, you know, like that's the danger is we want to be a lot better at cryptography than these things. And cryptography is the box that they live inside of.
Right on. Mohsen.
Yeah. So I'm not an expert in cybersecurity, but in my view, I think like cybersecurity should be a very serious concern when we talk about like, you know, AI in agriculture. But it shouldn't like stop us from using AI. But you know what? In agriculture, I see cybersecurity is not only about protecting computers or the data, but is also protecting trust. And the trust is the real foundation of the AI adoption when it comes to the farmers. Like, that is why I'm saying, like, you know, cybersecurity is the very serious concern in agriculture, because if we are just breaking this kind of trust, that's not a good sign. So as Donald said, some of the data, there is no need for the data to go outside of the barn, like, you know, outside of the field. So we can, like, you know, develop so many different infrastructures or so many different, like, you know, ways and approaches to handle this type of data. But, and in, like, you know, in the breeding, I can tell you that one way that we are trying to increase the security of the data that we are producing is to assign different numbers, like, you know, assign different IDs and everything, and protecting them from, like, you know, being used by others. And then we try to come up with the good, like, you know, who owns the data, where we are going to store the data, when we are and how we are going to use the data. We always have the version controls, and we are securing all this data, like, you know, in different infrastructure that university provided. So these are all different steps that we are taking to make sure that the data that we are collecting and data that we have right now are in a highest protection level. But again, I see, like, you know, cybersecurity as a very serious concern. And yeah, we need to also build more infrastructures and more using more approaches to make sure that the data that we are producing are secure and safe.
Well, and I appreciate you using the word trust, because I think trust is something that is often associated with, say, the adoption of AI, and certainly the federal government centered trust in their national AI strategy. I feel both of you have already kind of addressed a lot of the prerequisites that users kind of require for trust. To what extent is trust an ongoing moving target? And I say this because I kind of feel in today's conversation, we've gone through leadership, we've gone through governance, we've gone through kind of research and application. But I think the bias, once again, that all of us have is literacy and curiosity, right? We like to learn new things. We like to explore these types of systems. Not everyone has that. A lot of people are just overwhelmed by the day-to-day and what they focus on. I say this as a way to segue into the climate side of this discussion, because it strikes me that while we often talk about AI in terms of productivity, we talk about AI in terms of research, one of the areas that I think AI can be particularly powerful is managing complexity and managing uncertainty. And it strikes me that that's exactly what climate volatility and the kind of climate crisis that I think the super El Nino brings to us this year. All of that is a grand transition to kind of ask the question, what role do you think AI can play in responding to our changing climate? And Mohsen, I'm going to throw to you first, because I suspect you are well ahead of the rest of us, both in terms of anticipating the needs of the beans that are going to be growing in volatile environments, but also in terms of some of the digital twinning and some of those simulations and research you do. So taking this question from any angle you desire, where do you see the role of AI in helping us respond to climate change, not just in a reactive sense, but in a proactive sense, so that we start actually feeling like this is a kind of crisis we're capable of responding to effectively?
Yeah, no, that's a very great question, Jess. The point is, I can start from the plant breeding side. So in plant breeding, we are trying to make a cross, and then we are advancing the lines for the next 8 to 10 years. So we are selecting potential parental lines right now with the hope that the children, the progeny of these parents, are going to be superior in the next 10 years. So you can't imagine, like, we are seeing how, like, you know, climate has been changed over 10 years, right? You know, we are seeing more frequent, like, you know, extreme weathers. And that's something that we are not able to try to see on the history. We are not able to learn from the history. It's something that we are facing something new every year. And weather is always ahead of us and surprising us, this kind of climate change. So all this AI, and I can tell you predictive AI, like all the predictive AI models are trained based on whatever data that we are collecting from the field. So we call them input and output. So the output is actual yield, actual performance of plant. And the input is the historical data, like the historical climate that we have, right? So we are expecting to predict the performance of plant based on the historical climate, environmental data that we collected from different stations, weather stations. And then we try to predict the performance of these specific plant for the future. Where in the future, we are not able to see what's going on, what will happen in terms of the extreme weather, extreme like events that happen. So one thing that we are doing and we used to do was to try to collect some of the climate change scenarios, all the data that is available based on different anthropogenic climate change scenarios. They call it RCP, Representative Concentration Pathway. They recently changed it to the SSH. It's social, society, something like that. I couldn't remember what is the actual acronym means, but it's SSH. So there are different levels. It started from 2.4 down up to 8.5. So 2.4 or 5 is the case that the climate change is very mild and so good in the future. So nothing is going to happen, like everything will be perfect in the future. What would be the temperature in each location look like? So scientists predicted that. And then climate like RCP 4.5 is everything is exactly the same as now. What will happen in terms of the climate, like, you know, all the variables in the future? And 8.5 is the worst case scenario. If the fossil fuel will be bad, like, you know, we are burning more fossil fuels and there are so many wars, there will be so many wars in the future. So what would be the temperature in different locations? What would be the climate patterns in different locations in the, like, you know, in the future up to 2100? So we have this data. We can also use this data as a testing in the AI. But again, pay attention that we have output, which is the performance, and the input, which is all these like average, daily data, whatever that we have. So something that I've mentioned last time, and I wanted to also, if there is a time, I wanted to discuss about it, is the compute, like, you know, quantum AI. So in the quantum AI, the reason that I'm thinking that future is belongs to the quantum AI is because in quantum AI, we are able to search more thoroughly, not only looking at the input and output, but also try to find all these combinations. Let me provide a clear example. Let's say that you are flipping a coin. So when you are flipping a coin, the normal computer or the AI, predictive AI, they just counting the number of the times that the coin landed as a head or tail. And it, at the end, when you just flip the coin, it will tell you that in what percentage, in what possibility you will see head or tail, right? But how about only look at one time that we are flipping coin? Coin at each position has different, different possibilities. One time is head, one time is coin. Head, tails, right? And then do you think that it's landed, the possibility is 50-50? Like 50% head, 50% tail? How about head, tail, and landed as head? So we have 4 heads and 3 tails in one event that happened. So quantum tried to capture these kind of things in one data that we have. So no matter how many, like sometimes that we are seeing AI is not able to predict perfectly, we are trying to collect more data. But how about using the best, whatever that we have? And then in these kind of possibilities in agriculture, we have genes, we have climate, we have agronomy practices, we have so many areas, and all these having so many combinations. So the events that we are, the output that we are seeing in 1 year is only one combination. But how about considering all of them? And this is something that we are trying to move toward that. Like capturing all these combinations, try to see how many of these combinations has the highest possibility that happen in the future based on the climate change scenarios. And then the next step is to design digital twin. So we are at the University of Guelph in different sectors. In food science, I know that, you know, I'm collaborating in some of the proposals. They are using digital twins in plant breeding. We are starting to use the digital twins. And last year I started to do that. And I can tell you that all the crosses that I made, like 90% of the crosses that I made last year was because of the AI. It was the AI crosses. And I'm waiting to see what would be. Can't wait to see what would be the result, like in the field. But anyway, we try to design digital twins based on the facilities that we have. We have growth chambers, and we can set different temperatures, set different, like, you know, conditions that will happen, likely happen in the future, and also investigate all this and assessing all these combinations of the genes, environment, soil, all these kind of things in a very small scale, and then test the highest possible one in the field, and then make a selection and select for the potential parental lines. Maybe some of the parents that we are selecting today, their performance is not good. They are not providing, they are not good at all. But they will be good in the future, in the next 10 years, based on this climate. So if we are using the conventional methods that we have, we will definitely discard all these bad ones. But if we are adding computing, quantum AI to that, we may able to find more, patterns. We may able to, get the best juice, again, out of all the data that we have. And then we can make our selection more accurate and maybe select something that is not good right now, but it will be good for tomorrow. So, yeah, that was the strategy that we are taking here in terms of the research.
Well, and I am grateful again for you really helping me wrap my head around the revolutionary potential of quantum computing, especially when it comes to the wide-ranging probabilities that any farmer has to deal with when making decisions. Donald, there was a lot there to build upon. I do want to bring us back to the way in which climate and climate volatility can be assisted by AI. But I suspect your mind was also blown by the quantum implications there. So by all means, take it whatever direction you wish.
So sorry, Donald, before you talk, I forgot to tell something that, like, you know, the credit of the quantum AI, I just wanted to give the credit to people who bring that idea and we discuss. So the credit of the quantum AI is Dr. Rosita Dora. She is computer scientist at University of Guelph. And we have AI for food in Silicon initiatives. And we were all on the same table. We had a lunch and she was talking about the quantum and we were discussed this more thoroughly. So I just wanted to also give the credit to Dr. Dora as well. But yeah, please, Donald, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the probability that the coin exists is almost 100%, you know, not quite, but so it's quite a universe. And when Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote The Social Contract just before the French Revolution, he probably wasn't aware that there's a less than 100% chance that the coin actually exists. But nonetheless, you know, governance remains incredibly important and the human element in it. I mean, my thoughts on quantum are that, you know, it's kind of a tailwind to this idea that the RAM companies have quadrupled in value and that, you know, that the U.S. economy should be investing $700 billion in compute. You know, is there a path here where we can bring a tremendous amount of compute to the world without necessarily having to build these massive data centers? So, yeah, I mean, we can see the venture capital space around quantum is increasing. I'm sure there's brilliant students at Waterloo who are at the absolute forefront, and I'm sure they're all very excited to move to the United States to commercialize their technology. On the climate change piece, I mean, I've been trying to make a carbon credit since I got to the Federation in 2021, and I couldn't move the ball forward on it until I had the benefits of large language modeling and, I mean, the protocols and the data requirements and the documentation is simply too much for a grassroots NGO without the benefit of all written history broken down and modeled. And then when I feed it a Vera document, I can actually push the ball forward. And so Mod found VT00014 for us, which allows us to model soil carbon the way that we want to model it. She also found a number of different pathways. I think, Jesse, when you talk about complexity and climate change, these tools and their ability to identify relationships between data sets that we haven't previously considered is immense. And I think that will, in a number of different ways, bring value to farmers. And the convergences between disparate data sets that these tools unlock is very exciting. And simply, like, the ability to create simulation environments. You know, as soon as we fed Mod the necessary data, we do now have a 50-year biogeochemical model for Prince Edward Island. That's sort of the first foundation from which the whole system runs, and our farmers, our users, benefited from it immediately. So managing the climate and managing the impacts of climate change. And additionally, I mean, we had a once-in-a-lifetime, or what was a once-in-a-lifetime drought last year in Prince Edward Island that cost our economy $500 million, which is a big part of our economy. And so I prompted Maud if she could sort of manage climate risk the way that I've always wanted to manage climate risk. And managing climate risk and adapting to climate change has always been a messy, qualitative, multi-stakeholder data, you know, qualitative data analysis problem. And Maud has sharpened it up dramatically, identified the key data sets, brought in the data that she has available. And I believe very quickly we've built something that can ensure that every dollar we invest in irrigation in Prince Edward Island reduces risk by the maximum amount. And so that's very exciting. So On the mitigation side, I don't think you can make soil carbon credits effectively without LLM technology. And on the adaptation side, certainly managing complex hazard risk modeling and reducing that risk effectively with investment. I think on adaptation and mitigation, as well as understanding when the actual weather impacts come, how to respond to those. I think on all pieces, you know, as someone who's very passionate about responding to climate change, you know, this technology is certainly the biggest leap forward, you know, since the advent of the Post-it note.
I'm just going to jump in here. I realize we're running short on our time, and so maybe I'm prepping us up for our third panel because this could be a bit of a loaded question. But how do we reconcile all the benefits of AI in terms of our ability to adapt to and potentially mitigate climate change against what some people are calling the drain and the environmental impacts that these AI data centers are having in terms of water use and energy use? How do we reconcile that as an industry?
Aggressively. Managing natural resources is about engaging with all of the stakeholders effectively and understanding how everyone values economic capital, social capital, and environmental capital. It's up to the stakeholders to identify how they want to distribute that. That's why governance capital is so important, because it controls the distribution of those capital buckets. So we need good democracy. Democracy is crypto and capitalism is AI, right? Like, we need democracy to keep us safe and control our capitalism and ensure that capital is being distributed between those three buckets according to the wishes of the stakeholders. And weighting those stakeholders, you know, is a challenge, but certainly not impossible, and is a wonderful sort of place to be working to create a more sustainable world.
I can add to that. So, you know, Jen, I can't talk about this like topic for hours. The point is, we need to be honest that AI has cost. So there is no doubt on it. Like, AI has a cost. But the way that we are using AI, it can just justify the cost. Let's say, as a plant breeder, I make a selection for the future I try to use AI to release a cultivar that would be useful for the future and would be perfect and produce higher yield in this climate change, right? You know, all these volatile things that we are seeing right now. So I'm using AI for developing this variety. At the same time, let's imagine that I'm not using any AI and I don't have any information that what will happen in the future, and I don't have the predictive ability to do that. So I'm releasing some varieties in the future that maybe those varieties are not good, and farmers need to add more fertilizers, more pesticides, more herbicides to that. And then so many of these kind of things are going to deplete to the soil, spread to the environment in the future. And the cost. So 10 years, I'm right now using AI, and of course, whatever I'm using, it has a cost of the water, using water, carbons, all those kind of things, and it's bad for the environment. There is no doubt on it. But let's imagine the world and the prediction, the breeding without AI for the future. How about consuming more fertilizers and those kind of things? That's even worse for the environment. So these two has the cost, but which one has the better cost is the use of AI in this case. Also, when we are using AI, we need to come up with a good strategy. That's something that I was just thinking for months, and I couldn't find a single answer to that, is how we can better communicate with AI and encourage people not to use AI in for everything. Like, I'm seeing every emails, like more than 90% of the emails that I'm receiving right now is written by AI or, like, you know, formatted by AI. Why? What's the reason? I wanted to make a mistake. I wanted to make mistake and writing some words, like having some typos and everything, is way better for the environment that we are living. Even one email is nothing for me, but let's compare it. Let's consider it like for the as a worldwide. How many emails we are sending to AI to rephrase, revise for us, right? That's something. And even, you know, we are not paying attention to the actual models that we are using. Sometimes we are using like GPT-5.5, whatever, the latest one, for revising one email. So it's, I'm usually telling everyone that it's look like that you are getting a very expensive, fancy car and running in a like a street with maximum 30 kilometers. Why you wanted to do that? Right? That's not even good. And we need to have this kind of policy. I was just thinking of developing a kind of software that can use us in between as a middle between like the user and the AI. And it can just like, you know, understand what kind of models your question require and then use a specific model. Or sometimes the way that we are talking to AI, no one trained us. This is something that just came up and we are all started to adopt it without fully understand how to better communicate with AI. So I'm seeing that so many times we are writing an actual letter. Hey AI, I wanted this, and then please do that, and then add this part. So this is a very small example that I'm telling, but you can just see it on the larger scale, how much we are wasting tokens, how much we are wasting energy. So you can't believe that, you know, this type of emails that you are, or this type of text that you are sending to AI, it has like AI need to like read first. That costs energy. And then we call it intent. Just keep all your intent. That costs another energy. And then reasoning of the AI, thinking of the AI, that costs energy, and then provide you the response. So how about keeping everything short, understand how to better communicate with AI in a very short and consuming very less tokens, and then be efficient, and then use AI wherever we are really needed, not for everything, right? That's something that we can do it, but at the same time, in terms of the research, you should see the cost and the balances. Like with AI, without AI, what would be our future look like and what would be the environmental cost?
And that's, I think, a brilliant frame for us to both end on, but think about our next panel, our next gathering, because as Mohsen was kind of, I think, quite brilliantly sketching out the economics of, you know, having a sports car, a super sports car to go out and get groceries when you could walk to get the groceries, which would be far healthier.
There we go.
Imagine that applied to greenhouses, because greenhouses are a topic I'd like to talk about next time. I think what I'll do is I will go out and get a guest from the greenhouse industry, interview them as a solo episode on the podcast, and then invite them back for our panel. Because Mohsen, what I was thinking about is, on the one hand, yes, greenhouses are great for Canada. They help us grow stuff. But they are resource intensive. They are environmentally intensive. Maybe there are some crops that don't belong in greenhouses that we should be thinking about growing in less intensive growing environments. Again, a question for a future episode. But I think, if anything, what these panels are allowing us to do is, on the one hand, make sure that Jen, your literacy, your understanding of this is constantly upgraded, because if anything, you are part of the reason we're doing this, is to make sure that other leaders within the sector can understand these questions and understand these issues. But I don't know about you guys, my questions tend to be increasing faster than my answers. I leave every discussion we have with a whole bunch more topics that I want to discuss. So I am grateful once again for your time and expertise, and invite you all back so we can keep having these conversations and really fostering the kind of cross-sectoral conversation that we're successfully having.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. You know, every time that I'm coming here, I'm also learning at the same time, like from Donald, from Jen, from you, Jess. I'm just learning. And yeah, I would be happy to continue that discussion as well. Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah, thank you. Let's talk again soon, guys. Have a great day.
Indeed, a great day was had by all. Certainly, I hope you had a great day listening to that conversation. Again, due to some of the technical issues, I've already listened to that conversation many times, something I normally loathe to do when having to produce an episode for the podcast. But in this case, I quite enjoyed it. There were multiple layers to the insights that Mohsen and Donald offered. And again, my gratitude to them for taking time to engage here on the podcast. And I think really elevate our understanding of AI, our ability to see the vista, the imminent event horizon, I found incredibly valuable. Now, as I've mentioned, AI has been a recurring thread here on The Future Herd. We've got an episode already recorded, not yet released, with Dr. Suresh Raja, a professor in AI and livestock at Dalhousie University. That was a fantastic conversation that I'm eager to drop. And I'm working on a virtual event for The Future Herd on open source and AI for mid-fall. So keep an eye on that, and I'll continue to drop hints every now and then. Thanks again for listening, for engaging, for rating the podcast on your favorite podcast network, for sharing it with your friends, or for sharing it with your revolutionary cell plotting to destroy all data centers and enact the Butlerian Jihad. No matter where you lie on this particular zeitgeist issue, we're glad that you've joined us and listened to what we've had to say on the issue. Until next time, I'm Jesse Hirsch, and this is The Future.